5th year.
During my brief research into what you do, I saw that you are a CMU alum.
Yes, it's true. I graduated in 1984.
What made you decide to come back here?
They called me. I was originally a drama student for a year, and then I switched to sculpture and graduated from there and went out and worked for 3 years, and then they called me out of the blue and asked me to come back and teach. So the rest is history.
I heard through the grapevine, because we know each other, that you have experience working on feature films.
Yes, it's true. Yes, that is correct.
I saw that it was like construction, special props, and consulting. How did you get introduced to doing this?
One of the things that the sculpture world teaches you is that there's no jobs in the sculpture world if you get a sculpture degree. But what it does teach you also is that there are businesses out there that use all the same technologies and techniques and materials and strange problem-solving strategies that dovetail very nicely into that. And the one business that I still had kind of a background interest in was entertainment, motion pictures, television, etc. And when I started here at CMU, that is what this department is. And then because of my woodworking experience, I immediately got a job on a movie building specialty stunt props for Night of the Living Dead, which was being shot here in Pittsburgh. And we had to do a custom railing for somebody to fall through. And that was a perfect segue from one discipline into the other. And from there, it was just, oh, you can do that? Oh, you've done that? Next thing you know, here we are, many, many years later. So
that's really cool. How many films have you done since that?
I'm 20-some, but I stopped doing it about 10 years ago because it was too many other things going on. But it will consume your life completely. And I was doing it as a side job on top of my full-time job. And it's easily a full-time job on its own. Especially if there's more than one movie in town, then you just don't sleep. So, yeah, I could go back over and count how many it is if somebody really needed an actual number, but it's over 20, so.
What was it like going from that experience and then coming back to CMU? Like, how are maybe, like, the people different in that field and then?
Now, we are that field. The drama department, we train those people to go out into that business. So it's the same bunch of crazies that you deal with, and the same ridiculous deadlines and the same budgets, the same lack of sleep, the same intensity of work, attention to detail. It's very, very, very rewarding and very, very fast paced. And our department is very, very much the same way too. So our students are really, really pushed really, really hard to get the best out of them. And that is what the entertainment industry is very, very much based on, that mentality too. So they really expect people to just show up and give 100% or more all the time, every day until the show's over. And then everybody goes in their own way, and then somebody else comes in and starts it all. And that's just to get things done that fast and that accurately again and again and again. There's very, very little room for taking a breath or making any mistakes. So that's what we train.
Yeah, so it's just different place, but same exact type of people, same vibe.
It's very, very similar. And the big, big difference is the movie business pays so much better.
What films did you do? Like, maybe what was one of your favorites that you worked on?
We've done bits and pieces on a lot of them, but one of the ones that we had the most work on was a film called Striking Distance. It was a Bruce Willis film that they shot here a while back in 1992. And that was just an entire summer of not all day every day, because I was working here doing pre-college as well. We were doing special props on that movie, so they just needed various things like a huge pile of artificial rock cocaine. They needed a rubber shotgun that they could smack somebody with. It was shot on the rivers, so they had a police boat that they needed to have completely outfitted with all the electronics and lights and siren and all that stuff, so we did all that. They had a van that they just handed us a a blank van and said, hey, turn this into a broadcast media van. So we had to put all the antennas and all the telescoping satellite dishes, which we all had to build everything from scratch, too. Yeah. So it's a really wide variety of stuff that they ask you to do. And you never know what you're going to get. And that's the nature of the business, too, is they have something in their mind and they show you a napkin sketch and they say, can you build this? And then they say, how much? And you kind of come up with an idea how you're going to build it, what it's going to be made out of. And very oftentimes you haven't used these materials before and you just have to sort of trust yourself and just throw yourself into it. And somehow or other, we were never late. They always loved it. I have no idea looking back on it how that ever happened, but it's so fun and it's so stressful. And it's really neat compared to the theater world because you can always go back years later to this day. I can go on YouTube, pull up any one of those movies and any one of those segments and scroll through the segments of those movies and show anybody any of the props that we built. If it made it to the movie, because a lot of things you make, they end up on the cutting room floor. They get edited out for whatever time reasons or whatever. But anything that did make the movie, you can always go on there and say, scroll through and say, yeah, there it is. There is Ben Affleck stabbing Matt Damon with this knife that you made. So it's really fun. And there's a history. It's documented, so that's what I like about it, compared to doing theater work where everything goes in the dumpster.
Yeah.
So.
You keep saying we. Is the we like you and other people at CMU, or did you work with a group?
When we were doing movie stuff, I was an independent contractor always.
Okay.
Pretty much. So I didn't join a union or anything. We just had our own shop at home. My wife and I were basically the company. She was a painter more. She'd do the custom painting work on things, and I would do all the structural, actual construction of everything. And then periodically, we did a movie called The Piano Lesson, an August Wilson movie for Hallmark Channel, and they needed a carved piano, and it all had to be carved from scratch. You know, they gave us drawings that they wanted it to match, and there was just too many hours involved carving it. So at that time I was still connected with the wood shop where I used to work. We did a lot of hand carving at the wood shop. So I called one of my friends there and hired him to come in and help me. He was a really good master wood carver. So we spent a lot of time together just carving all these wooden panels all over the piano. So depending on who you're working, what your project is, who you're working with or who you're working for, you can tap back into your former or present lives and get different people with different skill sets to jump in on the project and then jump back out again. And if they're really busy and they don't want to do it, that could be a real problem, but usually you just show them a stack of money and they're like, oh yeah, I have time for that.
Olav, your son, told me that you have a piece of glass from The Silence of the Lambs.
It's a piece of Lexan, yeah.
Yeah. How did you do a lot of props for that?
No, I didn't even work on that. We were on another project at that time when that was being filmed here. But it was a piece of Hannibal Lecter's cage, the Lexan panels that somebody had made for the movie, because they don't generally go to the store and buy those things. Most of what you see is made, custom made for stuff like that. And when they tear down sets, a lot of it gets thrown away. A lot of it, if it's very interesting little pieces, people tend to hang on to as mementos of their experience, or they think that maybe they can use it for something. Well, one of my good friends from back in the day, Lou Taylor, who was the construction coordinator on that movie, he took that with him, one of those panels. Who knows what happened to the other ones, but he took it with him and then brought it onto another movie that I was working called, a Stephen King movie called Dark Half, that was shot here. And they needed that panel as a backing panel in a shower door so they could slam against the shower door without breaking the shower door. And when that movie wrapped, he just happened to have it and said, I know how to do that. I have just a thing for that. We can shine light through it and you can't see it. And then when that movie wrapped, he didn't want that thing anymore. I was helping clean up and I said, can I have it? And they said, get it out of here. So now that's in my basement. So you do tend to keep things that are kind of unusual and neat. I was going to make a dining table out of it. But I never did.
Okay, I wanted to know the story behind that because I'm just a big horror movie nerd. But I'm talking to Ben Carter, instructor at the theater department in CMU, and I just wanted to keep talking to you about what you were doing in the film scene here. You said that you would do stuff for props, like, in your backyard. Is that where you would mostly do stuff?
Or in our shop, in our home. We had, at that point, when we first started doing it, we had bought a building down on the north side, an old salad dressing factory, and turned it into our house. So we had an apartment, we had a shop, we had a garage, and of course a music room, because, you know, you have to have a jammer. And the shop was a pretty good sized shop, so there was, you know, a metalworking area, a casting and mold making area, a carpentry area, a drafting area, and there was just every, because you have to use so many different types of technologies and tools and materials, coming back to the sculpture world, it's all those things all just came back together into an actual job that actually works, that actually makes money, that's objective. The sculpture world and art world is completely subjective, and the whole value of everything you do is completely up to the viewer or the art gallery owner, whatever, which is really, really kind of unknown, and you can't count on paying your bills that way. So yeah. All those same technologies and all those same materials and techniques and everything, they all translate directly into entertainment, where you need all that same stuff. And there it is, and it worked. And you can say for sure it's more like an engineering job, where you can say, yes, that actually fulfilled the project goals successfully, and here is your paycheck, moving on, instead of being just sort of surreal and weird, which is the art world. So I
just want to wrap up what we've talked about. Based on when you were involved in it, how was the Pittsburgh film scene in general? I know we've talked a lot about it. I know we've said it's kind of not very different from CMU because it's all the same people, but based on, you know, when you were there, how was it?
At CMU, you mean?
In the Pittsburgh film scene.
Well, it's been going on for 100 years.
So,
And it kind of comes and goes depending on a lot of different things, you know, tax incentives and things like that. And other cities are always trying to get the money and get the business to come here. And we'll go a year sometimes without something, and then sometimes we'll have three or four films being shot here at once. And right now, Mayor of Kingstown is shooting again. We just drove by the prison today, and there's a row of Haddad's trucks, which is, you know, the local people that support all the logistics of that. So they're still filming away again. I haven't committed my life to the industry, so I'm really sort of superficially involved in it. Like, I would just jump in and jump out as needed. I never, ever once had to make a phone call and say, hey, does anybody have any work? It's more like I'd be doing something already and somebody would call. Or once people know what you do, they don't want to do job interviews and research. They want to call someone and say, hey, I'm in town, I don't know anybody who does this. And it's a relatively small community in this town, about in the movie industry, so everybody knows everybody. So if somebody says, who does special props? There's only a couple people that do it. Now, I don't do it anymore. Unfortunately, there's a couple other people around that took over that and do it on a really large scale. And we still stay in touch and can compare ideas and things now and then, too. But you can't really say it's a thriving industry. There was a point where it was a few years ago, probably 20 years ago. A lot of local carpenters quit their construction jobs and just joined the union and became full-time movie carpenters. And then that's not a good way to do it. You make lots of money for, you know, 6 or 9 months or something like that, and then that movie wraps and they're gone, and then you don't know if another one's coming. Yet you've quit your jobs and you don't know what you're going to do, and then maybe you take on another construction job and another movie comes in. So sometimes they overlap too. So like you're really heavy deep into one and another one starts and they want you to come work for them, yet you're already signed on to this one, and they don't really care if one is already going. So the industry is just like that. And in Pittsburgh, where we're not really historically like LA or something, which is like known for being a movie town, outside of Pittsburgh, it's not as reliable as a source of income, for instance, if you want to dedicate your life and family and your bills to it. So doing it as a subcontractor occasionally was really, really fun and really nice. So it was. It's too much now between, you know, life and family and puppies and Airbnbs and things like that. No more.
Yeah. I'm talking with Ben Carter, a theater instructor at CMU, and I want to talk a bit about what you do at CMU now, because if you can't hear, we're in the scene shop, lots of background noise, people talking, movement around, and you have machines here that you can kind of do stuff with. And
Yeah, the nature of a scene shop is kind of interesting, because what we do in the theater is we basically make a microcosm of the real world on stage. So it's all the same materials. It's all, you know, plumbing and electrical and carpentry and metalworking and welding and machining and all the same things that you would have in the real world, except on a much smaller scale. So we have to do bits and pieces of all the things. So if you had to hire a plumber or an electrician or a carpenter to do your house, we have to do all those things in little bits and pieces, but they all have to be just as functional as they would be in your real house, but on stage. And then to support that, our shop has to have the same capabilities as if you were building an entire house, basically, all the same stuff. So we have tons of carpenter equipment. This whole side of the shop is basically for woodworking. That whole side of the shop is basically for metalworking. So we build more and more and more sets out of metals, mostly steel these days. And that all depends on the designer. We never know. So since we do things on a large scale, we like to buy machinery that's sort of scaled up for that we get from the industrial world, the manufacturing sector, basically. So our machines aren't what you would see like in a high school theater shop. They're pulled right from real industrial shops that are designed to run 24 hours a day.
Richard is pointing to the hamburger, like, right above your head.
Okay, so the hamburger, it's a cheeseburger, actually. One of the classes they do here in the advanced paint class is they have to do a sculpture out of something three-dimensionally. And sometimes they're very large. You'll see, like, there's a mastodon head over there and a dinosaur head up there. They make them as part of their graduate thesis projects, and they're usually big, and they're very fancy, and they're super well made. And they graduate, and they can't take that on a plane. So sometimes they just dumpster them, and sometimes it's just like, no, we really want that. So up, it gets hung on the wall or hung on the ceiling, and then that hamburger and that car, that was actually a prop from a show. But they loved it so much they couldn't bear to scrap it, so they hung it on the wall. We only have so much wall space, you know, so. But, like, the cheeseburger was just so funny, you know, that we couldn't do anything with it. And at least twice, people have come to us and said, we heard you have a giant cheeseburger. And one was a hamburger shop that wanted to borrow it for their opening of their hamburger shop so that they could have it. And somebody else needed it for some show somewhere. So we bring in our lift and we bring it up to take down the cheeseburger. It goes in a crate and goes away. But that's the kind of thing, if it's that cool and it's that easy to hang on to, it's just fun. And it's just, the whole industry is kind of, it's so silly. You know, the whole theater industry and everything, it's all fake and it's all silly. And sometimes you get to hang on to really cool stuff like that.
Yeah. When my brother and I came in here to make a sign for the film we were working on last summer, you graciously let us use your CNC machine.
Yeah.
So do you want to maybe take me on a walk throughout the shop and maybe show us what your favorite machine is?
Well, like I said, this is the woodworking area. We have the usual table saw and radial arm saw. So we have things for processing sheet goods like plywood and lumber. That's this whole side of the room. And that whole side of the room is the paint shop. So we build everything down here, and then we send it all down there one way or another. Sometimes it's too big, and sometimes we actually have to build it and then just ship it directly into the theater. Like this is all for Titanic. So
the staircase is going to be in the set for Titanic?
Yeah. And you see it's all bolted to the floor now so that they can run up and down on it and whatever. But you notice that it also really, really quickly comes apart so that we can take it in pieces. Sometimes we'll build a huge, huge set in here that can't come apart, and we'll put it all on wheels. And then we open that giant door. And there's another giant door that goes onto the stage. And then we get 20 people just to roll the entire thing in there in one piece. So sometimes we do little tiny things. Sometimes we do things that are 50 feet long. That's the nature of this business. So we would rather not have this monstrosity in the middle of the shop. But that's what we do. Yeah. It has to go somewhere. It doesn't fit anywhere else. So over here, so that's, like I said, that's all plywood, soft materials relatively that we cut over here. And this is all for metal. This is a milling machine that we're currently set up. We have a computer-controlled aspect of this machine that we can put a piece of material in there and then do some programming, and it will do a bunch of processing to the piece of metal for you according to the program that you did. So right now we have it set up to do that, as we were making some brackets for the lighting department to hang this lighting instruments on the front of the stage that don't exist. So they come to us and say, hey, we have this weird application for this stuff, and these things that we need, nobody makes. And that's kind of the nature of this business, is that people are always saying, we want you to fill this weird gap that nobody has ever filled before. And this is the materials, and this is the needs you have to do for it. So can anybody make that?
Yeah.
So this is one of my classes, advanced fabrication class. They come to us and say, hey, can your class make these weird things? I say, well, absolutely. So whatever the curriculum is for the day gets changed, and then we go off to make these weird things for them.
Yeah.
So we also use this for other things in class too. We just happen to be using it right now for that. I can show you an example of that over here.
Sure.
So there's also under there, there's a metal lathe. If we have to make custom round things, we do a lot of automation, a lot of computer generated automation and winches and things that move things around the stage. And we do a lot of adaptation of mechanical components. Like they'll bring us a sprocket or a gear or a shaft or a bearing, and they'll say, to make this work, we have to make this go with that, but that hole's too big, or this is too small, and if we have to make a hole larger or a shaft smaller, we'll put it on the lathe and turn it down until it fits, what make all the components go together. So not your usual scene shop stuff, but we're not your usual scene shop.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
But at the highest level of this industry, if you go out and look at the professional shops, who are doing, you know, the Broadway things and the touring rock and roll shows and things like that, they all have shops that are 10 times this size and way more sophisticated than this, as if it's actually a real manufacturing facility where they're making products. And they're making a product, it's just that product is usually used once or twice, or maybe on a tour or something like that, and then it's just shelved. So, but we have to do it with the same level of intensity and accuracy and tolerance and budgets and speed and all that. So it's a weird hybrid of worlds that collide. So we have metal cutting tools and metal drilling tools, another little miniature version of that milling machine, band saws for cutting metal, belt sanders for grinding metal, things like this iron worker machine, which does a whole bunch of different things. The machine I showed you right there, I had to set up to drill holes. This is one of those brackets. So it drills all those holes, and then we bring it over here and put it in here, and it does all these bends.
Whoa.
We have it all preset to little certain marks. You set it in there, you push the button, and it bends it up. If you want a sound bite, I'll give you an idea what it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
If I want to put it in there, if I want to do a bend, this is an extra one. So. And this has been changed so that angle isn't correct right now. But, I mean, that's a general, I mean, this is not a machine like so many other machines and materials that we have in the shop. Nothing has been at all, zero of this has been designed and engineered and built for the entertainment industry. It's all been taken from the manufacturing or construction or R&D or scientific community. One of those sectors, somebody has already made the machinery that we need, and we say, well, we have to make this thing. We need a machine to do that. We have to make enough of them that it's worth spending $80,000 for that machine. And when I started here, nobody had heard of any of this stuff, because we were just building things with hammers and nails and screws and then throwing it away. And,
oh, boy.
You know, and that's not how it's done today.
Yeah.
So you have to do things fast and repeatedly, and that's where things like this thing, this CNC router, come in handy, because we have to do huge square foot areas of scenery. So like you see that big, that those carts there with all those pieces of wood on them.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a notch cut all the way around the outside of them, and then some slots cut through the middle of them. If we did that by hand, it would take days and days and days of just doing it with a hand router or a saw of some sort, whatever. Well, we can take one of the sheets, fasten it down onto this thing, and it takes about 5 minutes to cut each one, and they're all absolutely perfect.
Do you keep up with what goes on in the drama department these days? Like, do you know about the
show? As I need to. There's a lot of people who, you kind of learn when you stick your nose into situations. There's so much going on, and there's so many people that are so overloaded with work that if you show an interest in something, next thing you know, even if it's a passing interest, next thing you know, you've got more responsibility than you wanted. And yeah. Something is your fault that you just asked a little question about. So I only know what comes through the shop, and I don't care what the designs are anymore. I don't when it leaves this shop, I don't care what happens to it. Basically, I just teach people how to use the tools, what they're actually building, or when they need them by, and all that. That's out of my world now. So we just try to get them really prepared to go out in the real world and be really, really active, creative problem solvers, and know, most importantly, to look at a project, no matter what the scale is, and say, this is my skill set. This is what kind of tools we have at this shop. This is what our personnel can do. And can we do that? How long will it take us to do that? Do we need to job portions of this project out to other shops? And maybe it's too much at all. And then eventually, how much will it cost? How long will it take? So the whole idea of most of the students that come through our shop here they're really pushing them to be managers and business owners, project managers. So, and estimators and integrators and logistics people out in on a really large scale stuff. Very few people leave here after spending the money and go back, you know, to be their high school technical director or a regional theater person. Some of them do because that's what they want to do. But once you get exposed to a lot of really, really high-end, really cool stuff here, and you meet a lot of people who have come through here who are now really huge in the industry, and they're going to come back in and say, oh, you want to go work at your high school, do you? Okay, and then they'll say, check this out. Look what we did. Then they blow their minds, and they're like, yeah, actually, I want to do something really huge and really interesting.
I'm sure it's nice for you to just kind of, as you said, be in your own space. And you had your experience with the industry, but now you're just chilling here. But is there anything you want people to know that we haven't talked about?
As far as like what to, you know, parting comments or anything like that, if you go see plays or if you go see movies or if you go see television, if you have any interest in the industry at all, wonder what it, and the only reason I'm in this business is because I always wondered when I watched a movie, how did they do that? Who got to make that thing? That is so cool. And then at some point, the door opened for me that said, you can actually do that. And I looked at my tools and my skill set and I said, my gosh, that is actually something that I might be able to do. Mm-hmm. And when I tried that, it was in fact what I wanted to do, and people told me, hey, you're good at this. So it was, next thing you know, we're 35 years later.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ben Carter, CMU shop instructor.
Yep.
It's super fun being able to work with you. I know I work for DR technically, but
that's
just
right.
Coming in and being able to see you all the time, talk to you
cool.
about the dogs.
Appreciate it.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, anything I can do to help, let me know.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Check my math and follow along. 88.3 over 100 is not 0.883. We exponentiate. Euler's number raised to not 0.883 is 2.418. multiply by 1,000 to result 2,418. Add 401, result 2,819. Multiply 25. 5 by 9 is 45. 5 by 1 is 5, and 4 is 9. 5 by 8 is 40. 5 by 2 is 10, and 4 is 14. 20 by 9 is 180. 20 by 1 is 20, and 10 is 30. 20 by 8 is 160. 20 by 2 is 40, and 10 is 50. Sum 70,475. Add 404. 70879. Multiply 11. Result 779669. Add 20. 779,689. Divide 10. Result 776.89. Square root 88.3 WRCT.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, this is Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and today I have Dean Shinas here to talk about freedom of speech on campus. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So free speech is a very broad topic you can probably talk about all day and all night. But specifically, I'm bringing you here because you've got a lot of expertise in dealing with it when it comes to college campuses. So what do you think makes the situation unique when it comes to this specific context?
Well, first, let me say this is not my topic. My expertise is a faculty member. But interestingly, I've had to become knowledgeable about it because of being a dean and all the things that have come up since I'm a dean for 10 years. So, you know, the big topic is that in order to actually do research and educate students and have people learn, there has to be a freedom of expression so people can test out ideas, they can say things that other people might find offensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so for us to actually function in the way we need to as a university, we have to maintain a healthy respect for and support for freedom of expression on campus.
Can you start us off by giving us an example of a context where you've had to deal with threading that needle between being respectful, being a learning environment, and also letting people speak?
Sure. We've had a bunch of different really interesting events. But when I was early on in my deanship, one of my English professors came to me and said, can we do a year of events commemorating Karl Marx's 200th birthday? And I was like, sure. And we did that set of events, and then somebody did an article in the Trib that was critical of us covering Karl Marx and was picked up by some national media, and the trustees were unhappy, called our president, called our provost, called me, et cetera. And the president was very supportive in saying, look, this is academic freedom. We need to cover this. But it was extremely difficult to convince everybody that this is a crucial thing we have to maintain as a university if we're going to actually, even when they were very much against Marxism, the idea of Marxism, and took it to be a threat to the world in general.
So I feel like that also brings into play academic freedom, which is somewhat of a different thing than freedom of speech. How would you say the two interact?
Well, in freedom of speech, which is from our Constitution, this is a legal matter, and they've made lots of different decisions in the Supreme Court supporting it. And over time, it's become more and more clear that they're going to be extremely unrestrictive of freedom of speech. Hate speech is protected speech, weirdly enough, legally. And the reason is because you can't identify a set of words as hate speech without the context, making it really, really clear what's hate and what's not. And the example I'll give is all lives matter. Nobody would think those three words by themselves are really hateful speech. But in the context of when George Floyd was murdered and the fence was painted, Black Lives Matter, And then someone came and crossed out black and put all lives matter became, I think, in many people's minds, an example of hate speech. And so I think that everybody in the legal system agrees that unless we can find a very, very clear definition of hate speech that we could apply in every context, then it's much, much better to not regulate it. On the academic side of the coin, in the academy, when research and education is the mission, there was, like many other institutions, no such thing as freedom of speech, because if you're in a company and you say something the company doesn't like, you can be fired, even though the Constitution protects your right to say it. It doesn't protect you from saying it for that company. So the academy had to actually add protections so that when you were working in the academy as a professor or a student, you had protections that were at least more than you could actually ask in a company you worked for. And this all started in the very early 20th century when professors were routinely fired for their political views, their views that were critical of the campuses they worked on, etc. And the American Association for University Professors came up with not a union, but an organization that tried to encode what do we mean by academic freedom and what does it actually allow us to do. And so from about 1915 until now, there's been a very, very powerful movement to try to make sure the academy protects freedom of speech and freedom of research and freedom of expression much, much more robustly than companies do, for example. Now, public universities are required to follow the constitutional protection, but private universities like Carnegie Mellon are not. We choose to.
So specifically, you were talking about Karl Marx, and that was Kathy Newman, who we have had on the show about banned books. But what would you say makes a university follow free speech? Because, I mean, Dr. Newman made the point that the Constitution is very vague. It's Congress shall make no law.
Right. Well, I would say the legal system and the way it's been the way the Constitution has been interpreted by the legal system is robustly protective of free speech. That's not to say that you can say anything you want. You can't make threats, right? You can't harass. You can't actually do child pornography. You can't do obscenity in public. There's many, many ways your speech is restricted. And in particular, time and manner. So if you want to say something politically, you can't go into someone's neighborhood and just shout it with a megaphone at 2 in the morning when people are expecting to be sleeping, right? So there's lots of ways in which there's restrictions. But I think in the academy, when we're trying to have an environment in which people can explore potentially controversial ideas, transgender rights, abortion, the Israel-Palestinian conflict, et cetera, et cetera. We need an environment in which people can explore different perspectives, different opinions, different, ways of thinking about this thing freely so they can hear counterarguments and so they can learn. And so the other topic I wanted to make sure I get to is the difference between the kind of restrictions or non-restrictions we get from the law and from policies on campus and the kind of restrictions on speech from social norms, right? So many students will tell me that, if they're on social media or they're in a group of friends, there's things they don't say because they're afraid of being shamed or they're afraid that what they'll say is looking at weird, it's not the in-group's opinion, et cetera, et cetera. So in my view, that's a much more powerful influence on restricting and chilling your speech than any policy I as a dean will put forth or we as a university will put forth. Would you agree?
I think it depends, because there's definitely ways that universities can fully shut down speech. But also, I do agree that social norms are a very powerful motivator.
I mean, we found just by looking at some data, asking some surveys and questions, that the students feel very uncomfortable sharing controversial opinions, especially if they're conservative opinions, with their peers on campus, not just in class. And so I think for sure there's a pretty large social pressure that many students feel.
Yeah. So I feel like that also doesn't just apply to students, because I know professors and academics also have a bit of an issue with viewpoint diversity.
Absolutely. So if you're a professor in a class, right, there's so many ways you can step on a landmine and do something that's stupid, right? And in many of these situations, you're not trained. Right? You're trained in your subject. You're not trained on how to manage class so that there's an appropriately respectful environment for a wide array of viewpoints. Nor are you trained to figure out how to run a class so that if there's a very small representation of a certain minority, you don't treat them in a disrespectful or harmful way. you know, I've seen at least a dozen incidents where professors were not just accused, but, you know, put into a situation where something they did in class was questioned. And then their reaction to it was to say, I'm not going to do any of this ever again. I'm just going to talk about my subject down the road and then leave. You know, so that's a really unfortunate chilling of what professors need to do as well.
Yeah, and also, I think a thing about professors is that most of them, by far, are more on the liberal spectrum. So that's also a thing where you only get one perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, we know that. And it's very, very difficult for professors to understand where the line is between challenging something they think is factually inaccurate, that something a person on the other side of the spectrum might say, or something that they just take to be sort of a misguided political perspective. And I think that I should also mention that academic freedom, as it's been understood, right, does not give professors, right, carte blanche to just weigh in on subjects that they don't really know. So if you're a physics professor and you just stop class in the middle of talking about neutrinos and say, I want to rant against Kamala Harris or rant against Donald Trump, that is not protected by academic freedom.
No. Well, if it's not your area of expertise, it's kind of a captive audience issue.
Yeah, I think that's true. And you have to be respectful of the fact that, you know, you might feel passionately about a subject and you might believe that you're opening the class up to discuss it in a very equal way. But there's a clear power imbalance, and the students have to know, or have to at least feel, that they're at risk of, if they say something that you find politically very, very untasteful, that their grade might be at risk as well. And I can't blame the students for feeling that. That makes perfect sense to me.
With, you know, the issue of students feeling afraid to challenge their professors or afraid to challenge the social norms of their friend groups, does CMU have any initiatives to try and counteract that?
Yes, we have several, and you were a part of one. So in the Dietrich College, we have a seminar program for first-year students called the Grand Challenge Seminar Program. We take topics that are challenging to the world: racism, climate change, food security, academic and freedom of expression. And we try to cover them from a multitude of disciplines. In the course of the Grand Challenge Seminar on Academic Freedom that I taught and you were a student in, which was a great experience for me, we spent a lot of time in the beginning trying to get the environment of the class to be bought into the idea of respect. So we were very, very passionate about telling everybody that no matter what people say, no matter how offensive it might seem to you, we must be respectful and welcoming of all viewpoints, all perspectives. And it took a few weeks, but the students, I think, were incredibly good about buying into that and actually exhibiting that behavior. And then when October 7th happened and the attack on Israel from Hamas happened, we turned the syllabus around and we said, let's discuss this. The fence was posting messages that were very, very provocative and offensive to one group or the other. And then in the class, I think the students took what we had tried to set up and really used it and were incredibly civil and very constructive. And I think we learned a lot. I mean, I learned a lot about the intent, right, of Palestinian-aligned students when the messages came out that Jewish students might find offensive, and what the Jewish students were hearing, and vice versa. And so it felt like real learning was taking place in a classroom. So I think initiatives, what we want to do is make sure that as faculty, we can teach classes in which we do the kind of civil discourse. We model it, we teach it, we encourage it, and we can see progress happen when students actually get something big out of that. And as administrators, we can try to create events and try to create other things that go on the campus, like the Deeper Conversations series we had, in which we're willing to take on these controversial issues as opposed to just being silent about them. We're willing to have discussions, and the conditions are that the discussions have to be civil. I feel like this is an issue we've just started to take on, but this is like one of the big issues that the academy or the institutions of higher education in the U.S., they need to lean into. If we can't take this on and get faculty and students to have civil discussions, no matter how polarized they might start, who's going to do it?
I feel like freedom of speech is especially a big thing on CMU's campus right now because there are new restrictions in terms of assembly and protest. So a lot of students have been protesting that and kind of are really upset about it. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's unfortunate because I mean, I know from my side of the fence on the administration that that was not the intent at all. So what's basically happened is when protests happen or when student expression on campus happens, with or without outside people, the university feels very responsible to make sure that's safe. And what we have experienced from last year is that some of the events get very passionate, and some of the people who are coming in from the outside or even coming in from the students are passionate enough that where they're trying to provoke something that I wouldn't say is just violence, but provoke something that will break out into potential violence. The campus police tell us that if they have notice there's going to be some event, right, that's going to be sizable, then they're going to be much, much more able to protect the safety of the people involved in that event, from people who came and were on counter-protests to whomever. And so the idea of the policy for 25 people to register was simply to give us a better ability to keep these events safe, and that we have a complete commitment to the content of the protest. Has nothing to do with it. So if you're a group that's liberal and you register versus you're a group that's conservative register, we don't care. The only thing motivating that is so we are better able to provide the security that we need to keep these things physically safe.
So as a reminder, this is Forbes Avenue. I'm Riota Duncan talking with Dean Shinas about free speech. So on that topic of the administration's view, you were part of the Commission on Academic Freedom and Free Speech. Can you tell me a little what it's like about being in that kind of room?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So the commission learned an awful lot about, what are best practices, what's the history of this thing. We got some great speakers to come in, Keith Whittington from Princeton, Erwin Chorminsky from Berkeley, other people too. And what I think we learned was that even though it's in many cases desirable to prevent people from doing events, having speech that is potentially offensive or hateful, that anything you might do to try to restrict that is probably worse in the long run than supporting the freedom of the students to hear all different kinds of perspectives, even if some people find some of them very offensive. Now, I say that, but in the room, in that committee, there were very clearly two sort of groups that evolved, and one group I would describe as more concerned with protecting, right, the environment from hateful, right, hateful speech or hateful groups or things like that. And another of the group, or the other side of the group, was more on my side, which is more supportive of free speech. I think both of us are passionately committed to the fact that we do not want a culture that's hateful or having things like that happen. But I think the approach that distinguishes us is, on my side of the fence, instead of doing it legally and with policies, let's try to do it culturally. Let's try to get the students, right, and the faculty and the staff, if there's someone coming in who's hateful, to push back on them. And so we need to protect the speech of the people pushing back on the haters as much as we need to protect the speech of the people who are potentially hateful. But on the other side of the fence, I think there are people who say that's not going to be good enough. There's still going to be people who are coming in and being anti-Semitic or, very hostile to abortion rights or transgender rights or other things that are controversial. And that letting those people come to campus and speak, right, is creating an environment that's simply unsafe or unconducive to learning. So it was a tricky issue to try to figure out where we actually came down on. And so I think in the end we agreed that we'll modify our policy a touch, but that we were going to be robustly protective of freedom of expression in general. In the long run, we think that's a better strategy.
I forget who said this, but someone said that the best response to hate speech is more speech.
I agree with that. I mean, here's the thing. You might think that I'm a okay person, and I'm okay, well, maybe not, but you might think I'm okay. So if I have to make a judgment on whether something's hate speech, you might trust me to do that reasonably. But we know from history that if the deans and the provost and the president have the ability to shut down speech because they deem it hateful, then someone down the line is going to abuse that power. And then the people end up suffering the most from that ability of administrators to shut down speech are the people who need it the most. And so to sacrifice that people or those people in the future, right, in the present, giving us more power to sort of push back against what might be considered offensive and hateful, not to everybody, but to some, seems to me a bad trade-off. And I think that we have to be willing to be uncomfortable in many contexts in order to protect it, so that down the road, some administrator who's not well-intentioned is not able to shut down students who have a really good point to make, or shut down protesters who have a good point to make. We have to hear it.
I was wondering what you thought of accountability mechanisms for free speech on campus or academic freedom, because for private universities like us, it's not that we're bound by Congress.
And I think we have to be clear in our policies to make that a value that we're actually putting out there as core value of the institution. So I think we did a great job on the Karl Marx thing. I think we did a great job on the Rick Grinnell, Ambassador Grinnell coming to campus. It was huge controversy over that. Many, many people wanted us to disallow it or fire him. We didn't. And I think there was a similar thing over Uju Anya and her critique of the Queen, right, which was also, I think, highly controversial. But we stood up and we protected her ability to say that, and Rick Grinnell's ability to say that, and et cetera, et cetera. So I think the policy has to be clear, and we have to actually walk the walk, not just talk the talk. We have to make it visible to people the positive side of it, right? And we have to make sure that people can have experiences in classes or in deeper conversations or in other places where they come out of it, right? They come through being offended. They come through being uncomfortable and learn something. So I just think we have to find ways to make it vivid and visible to our students and to our faculty that even though it might be uncomfortable, the positives are great.
So in terms of making it visible, how would you say Carnegie Mellon's been trying to do that?
Well, the two examples I gave, I'll go back to. One is the classes, and there's another class I'll point to called Dangerous Ideas, right, which Simon Cohen put forth, which explicitly took on the idea of very, very controversial topics and tried to get people to talk about them in productive ways, factually and otherwise. Danny Oppenheimer teaches a class called Human Stupidity and Human Intelligence, Thinking Online versus Thinking in Person. And in both cases, he takes on very controversial issues and tries to get the students to learn how to debate these issues, right, in ways that in the end will be much more helpful to them than just shutting each other down. And then the president and the deans, especially the dean of Hines and the dean of Dietrich, me, have made a pretty big commitment to these deeper conversations where we try to get the issues that are controversial of the day, the Israel-Hamas, Israel-Palestinian conflict, and now the election, the polarization that's a part of it, and lean in, get it out there, and try to create venues and events and forums in which people really can discuss these things and hear perspectives that are sufficiently diverse that they can learn. And I think in the deeper conversations last year, we were very nervous about it, but we had these discussion groups on this book called Contested Histories. We had about 10 people run discussion groups, and students, faculty, and staff were all invited to come in, and each one of them filled up. And by all reports, most of those conversations went very well. There were a couple of difficult issues that came up, as one would expect. But I think what came out of it was that we need to keep doing these things. So we're not afraid to talk about controversial topics. We invite the students to come talk about it. We get readings that actually matter. We get people to come lecture who are serious, who are not just provocateurs, right? These are all hard issues, or they wouldn't be controversial. So, I mean, I just think that we have not only a duty, but we've also seen that if we do it and we do it well, it works. And that's, to me, very exciting.
In terms of discussing controversial issues, what do you think about universities who put out, you know, statements about the hot topics of the day?
I mean, as a dean, I have been in several situations where, you know, people were pressing me and pressing the university to come out and say something in support of or in defense of or condemning. There's often a very, very strong number of people who can say, you need to condemn, right? And you're very conscious as a dean or a provost or a president that no matter what you say, you're going to, you know, make somebody angry. You know that, right? And you know also that you can't be just expressing what you believe because you're not speaking for yourself. You're speaking for the institution. And so that's inherently an impossible task and ridiculously complicated. And I think that more times than not, we get it wrong or we do more damage than we might have done by just staying silent. So I kind of believe that the default should be silence. We should not expect administrators, right, to take positions on social issues because that's not their job. Their job is to create an environment in which those issues can be explored, discussed, learned about, researched. But, right, not every issue can be, we can't be silent about every issue. And the example that everybody keeps coming back to argue against that with is, suppose you were an administrator in 1932, 1933 Germany, and the Nazis were taking over. I mean, you would not want to look back and say, I said, no, don't say anything. And the same thing, I think, about George Floyd. I mean, I think that was such a crystallizing moment in the struggles we've had with racism, you know, in our society, that for people to say nothing would have been inappropriate in a certain way. And yet, when we did come out with a statement, we got savaged from both sides, right? Some people say that statement's much too weak, and then some people said that's much too strong. So, you know, one tries to make it split down the middle to some extent. But I really feel like the amount of hours that administrators have taken over trying to get a message that they really think represents the institution appropriately, what its values are, and that addresses its constituencies in a way that they'll be able to hear as opposed to find offensive or objectionable, you would be stunned at. I'll just say that. And I don't really think that you want me, right, and the other administrators on campus spending a lot of our time and our emotional energy worrying about those kind of messages ad nauseum. I think you'd rather me spend my time worrying about, like, what kind of a great program can we put together, right, that brings together statistics in English, you know, for something like that. So neither extreme works. You can't weigh in on everything, and you can't weigh in on nothing. But I would much rather see the default be that nobody expects us to weigh in. Much, much cleaner that way.
So you were mentioning social media. How do you think that contributes to the whole situation on campus and in the world?
Let me go out on a limb here and say I deeply hate social media. I mean, I think so. We have had so many incidents where somebody had some reaction to something that got posted on social media. It blew up or ricocheted around, and people, you know, got very upset about it before I even knew about it. You know, so it's the cycle of the social media explosion. It's not a week. It's not even a day. It's just an hour. And so, you know, you can't find the people that need to address it and answer it within an hour or within 2 hours every time. It's not practical. And there's been so many times where somebody has taken something and then gone with it on social media that in retrospect turns out to be not just false, but radically false or misleadingly false, right? And so you're in this trap where the speed of it and the way it amplifies and reaches so many people is so overwhelming and so much beyond our own capabilities, right? Even if I go onto social media and try to actually stop the bleeding or say something, right? You know, inevitably, the speed with which I have to do it, I'll make some mistake and say something that somebody finds ridiculously, or and then that will be its own story. And so every time we've been in these situations and we consider, well, we need to respond to that. They're saying something we know to be false. Somebody else says, don't say anything. You'll just make it worse. You'll provide gas to the fire. And they're right. So as quickly as it blows up, it tends to die down. But I think in general, the social media that I've seen, it worsens the discourse in almost every way.
Social media is great at letting people speak, but it's not so great when it comes to amplifying, say, misinformation or dangerous lies or even just things out of context.
Correct. And it's also not so great at somehow creating an environment in which people feel entitled or safe to say truly horrible things, troll people, and use tones or use statements that they would never say face-to-face because they're just too offensive and they're too socially unacceptable. But in social media, there's no problem to say it. And I think it brings out the worst in us in a certain way. And I think it's just for all the political issues of the day, made everybody's life more stressful, more anxious, and worse. Is that extreme enough, Abby?
Well, I think a lot of people have a complicated relationship with social media.
Oh, yes. And I know I'm extreme. But I'm old. I'm in a generation where, you know, we didn't do social media, right? You know, and I brought up three daughters, and I remember this vividly with this age where when they were, like, interacting with their friends. Sometimes they'd speak in person. Sometimes they'd call them on the phone. Sometimes they'd text them. And they would modulate what they did depending on how intense the interaction was maybe going to be, right? We never thought that. And so, you know, so I think the social media is just another outgrowth of that. It's a way to actually modulate how you're going to say something. But the way it gets amplified is just very unfortunate.
So if social media is part of the problem, what would you say is the solution to finding a good balance on this very thorny issue?
Well, I don't think you're going to stop social media. It's going to be what it is, and people are going to use it. And hopefully, over time, people will come to feel about social media that it's just sort of it's toxic, like, you know, like Twinkies are toxic, right? It's such a nice sugar high quickly. But if you keep eating Twinkies every day as your whole diet, you're going to feel like crap, right? And I think the same thing is true of social media. I think if that's your main diet and you get addicted to it, it's just stressful. You feel anxious. You don't feel good. So I think hopefully if we provide better and more opportunities for people to interact in person and have discussions that they actually can enjoy, et cetera, and learn from, that they'll choose to do more of that and less of the social media. That's pretty optimistic and hopeful, but I'll stick with it.
Well, is there anything else you want to say before we run out of time?
I think that when I have had the experience of getting students and getting faculty into contexts in which they have enough time and they have enough safety to say what they actually think and to explore it, they behave well and they behave incredibly intelligently and they end up doing things and saying things that we all learn from. So I believe that I've already seen enough evidence to show that if we can create the context in which speech, right, can be free and productive, that is going to be a positive thing as opposed to a negative thing. So I'm encouraged, but I think it's going to take us an enormous amount of work to get there.
This has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I've been Riona Duncan, and my guest today has been Dean Shinas. Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.